Hey, good afternoon, everyone. See our colleagues in a couple of the conference rooms up in Louisville. This is Mark Willis coming live from the boardroom in Lafayette, and we've got a number of colleagues here as well. And we have colleagues on the phone and also joining via WebEx on computer. So thanks, everyone, for taking some time out this afternoon for our quarterly town hall. I just want to remind everyone that this is primarily listen-only mode, and there will be a recording available of this town hall posted tomorrow in the Our Future portal, which is on the LHC Group employee resource page, which we also know as the homepage. And we'll send out another notification about that, just alerting everyone. So you can go back and listen, and those of our colleagues that couldn't join us today will be able to do that. We're going to hear from Keith first. He's going to give us a little bit of some commentary around the state of the company as we near year end. And then both he and Don are going to field a few questions that came in over the past few days from some people that submitted questions. So without further ado, I'll turn it over to Keith.
All right. Thanks, Mark. Well, good afternoon, everyone, and thanks for taking some time to join and join in this conversation this afternoon. As we said in our last town hall call that we hosted from the home office in Louisville, that we're going to do this quarterly and rotate from Louisville to Lafayette. So this is the Lafayette cycle. So it's interesting to do it from the other way around now. So looking at all our colleagues in Louisville. As Mark said, I'd like to just start with a few high-level comments about, kind of the state of the company, if you will, from my perspective. I'll ask Don to chime in on that as well, since he's here. First, I want to say that William isn't here today. William planned on being here, and he was flying up this morning to be here, and huge commitment to that, but he wasn't feeling well this morning. He's down with a little bug, so, you know, he sends his regrets. But just wanted to let you know where William was. This is just a great time for this town hall call because we're just coming off of our quarterly board meeting and annual board retreat, where we looked at not only the current state of the company, but spent a full day looking at our five-year strategic plan, and that was really refreshing because we've done that at LHC for many years, but needless to say, this year it was twice as big, and it was a much more complex exercise that took a lot more effort to plan for. Maybe more than we anticipated. And Josh is not here today, right now. He's at a meeting in Nashville. But if Josh were here, he'd be nodding his head really big because he and his team did a lot of the heavy lifting and all the numbers crunching. But the summary is that even though, you know, we're just 9 months from the effective date of the merger, from all perspectives, I mean, we just couldn't be more pleased with where we are. You know, does that mean that there weren't surprises, there weren't challenges? And not at all. If I even suggested such, all of you would think must be losing my mind. But, you know, when you do something of this magnitude, you know, it would be foolish not to factor in some level of expectation for things that are going to come up and go wrong. What matters is how we respond to them and how quickly and how effectively we do it and how open-minded we are to the possibility that there are going to be surprises, you know, so that we're not surprised by the surprises, if that makes sense. And I'm really proud of the entire team in the way that we faced those challenges and didn't get rattled and just thoughtfully addressed them and just continued on our journey and didn't let them throw us off base, which for me, just was further confirmation, not that I needed any, that I can say with a high degree of confidence, I believe it with everything I have, that we collectively now, not only do we cover over 60% of the population in the country, and we are the size we are, but we have the best-in-class, most experienced team in the home care space, period, full stop. You know, there are a lot of people that are generating results in certain measures that are impressive and equal to ours, but I just, and I realize, I recognize my bias, but I've been doing this a long time, and William has too, and a lot of you have. I don't think anybody stacks up against us when it comes to long-term commitment to the work that we do, why we're here. There are a lot of people that are passing through this business with short-term commitments. You know, this organization does not have an exit strategy. You never hear those words come out of our mouth, and of many of the people that are in this business are talking about exit strategy. This is more of a mission focus for us, which positions us to approach what we do from with a long-term perspective and make the kind of investments you make for the future that you wouldn't make if you were just in it for the short term. So I guess that's just a perspective that I hope comes across as being very appreciative to all of you, but also to our board members. I'm reflecting on the board meeting we just had. If we didn't have the type of board members we have, it would be more difficult for us to accomplish that as a management team, but they fully support that vision and the way we approach it. So we're just really blessed. I think that's the best way to say it. Let's see. I guess the other thing that's worth mentioning at the outset is, as you know, I spend a considerable amount of time in Washington, D.C., advocating on behalf of our organization, but also on behalf of the industry. And I just continue to be more encouraged every time I go to Washington by the awareness of the value that we have as an industry, and I mean providing health care in the home. So I'm not saying the words home health, because that would lead you to some people to think Medicare home health benefit, which is the biggest part of what we do. But now the conversation in Washington is more about care in the home. Like, any time that someone can be cared for in their home, it's less expensive and more patient-preferred than care in an institutional setting. And that is like a tsunami in Washington, D.C., and everybody understands that. People struggle with how to get there. I go, so how do we get more care in the home? Okay, there's a lot of different ideas and pilots and demonstration projects that are going on that we probably won't see that full picture for another decade, fully developed. But that's how policy moves in Washington, D.C. But the good news is that a decade ago, we were still fighting to defend the efficacy of what we do. We were challenged with proving that we could actually deliver value when people thought we didn't deliver value. And if you look at it in terms of, 10-year time spans, today we're sitting here where we don't spend one ounce of energy trying to prove to people that we deliver value. That is totally accepted. Now it's, how are you going to deliver it? How can we move patients? Because we know for sure when we move patients to the home setting, patients are happier, and everyone saves money, whoever the payer is. I view that as just a big win as a lifer in this business. And it positions us well to fight against regulations and reimbursement changes. We'll talk about it a little. I know that was something in the Q&A. We'll talk a little bit about that a little more in detail. But this the PDGM rule that came out doesn't go into effect till 2020. So the big, as most of you probably know, the big concern we have, I don't know if it's even fair to say it's a big concern, but the thing we'd like changed is the behavioral assumptions, the being made prospectively. And so we're seeking to change that to where CMS would not make changes until they observe a behavioral change. There's huge support for that, just from a sense of fairness and a penny-wise, pound-foolish argument. Like, why would you do something that even has a slight risk of slowing the momentum of moving care to the home just when we have momentum? It's any money that you would save in the budget by reducing home health by some small amount, you're going to spend many times over that amount, and you're going to have increased spending in SNF or something upstream from home health. And that resonates. We hoped to get that rule changed in, or get legislation maybe to move in the last quarter before year end, but with the House changing to Democratic, there's no sense of urgency since this rule doesn't go into effect till 2020. So what they're saying to us, we hear you, we agree with you, but what's the rush? It doesn't go into effect till 2020, so we'll deal with it when we come back after the first of the year. So no promises, but just a lot of support, for it from everyone we've met with. And since for all of you in Kentucky, I mean, especially with both senators from Kentucky, Leader McConnell's office, very supportive on this issue. Senator Paul, I spoke to personally, and as a physician, he dug in on this big time. he was offended and just referred this as an overreach from CMS, interfering with the practice of medicine, and he demanded to be allowed to be included in this movement and help move it. So any of you that bump into Senator Paul over the holidays, give him a thank you for that. Don, you want to add anything before we go to Q&A?
Well, I think, first of all, I'd like to say good afternoon to everyone around our company in the country, and good morning to those on the West Coast. You know, in Keith's opening comments, he talked about the challenges and some of the obstacles that we faced, and I don't think any of us at this time last year going into the merger were aloof enough to think that there wouldn't be. But I think every one of us have been so pleasantly surprised as the roll your sleeves up, except for what it is mentality of everyone that I know I've encountered. Along with the divisional presidents and some of my colleagues here, we've traveled around the country and met with teams from every single division inside of what I'll call the legacy almost family. And to the T, you know, were there questions that were tough? Absolutely. Were there concerns about self and direction? Unequivocally. But to the T again, everybody really has taken that step back and embraced what is good about this instead of sitting and complaining about those obstacles, Keith. And I was sharing something at the table here last week during our MOR and on a call with our operations team the week prior is if you really step back and think about what we're honored here to do and what I know I'm privileged to even be speaking to you about is November of last year, and even the month before, I personally didn't even know that life was going to lead us into the direction that we now sit in. I didn't know Todd, who I now see, and Gary in the back of the corner. I knew Cameron. There's no doubt I see you, Cam. But what I told our team was, from a year ago to now, not only have we become acquainted, we've become so collegial, so close, and honestly so aligned. Does that mean, Keith, that those challenges aren't still there and probably, dare I say, will be? Of course. But for every one of us, it's how we embrace it and how we live our purpose statement about helping people. So I'm excited about 2019. The transformation, still while it's in the mist, is, I think, the heavy lifting is behind us. Now, some of you on the phone, I know Lynn, who's going through conversion, would say, speak for yourself. But there is, as that saying goes, a light at the end of the tunnel, and I dare say it's not only not a train, but it's really opportunity knocking, and I think we're going to capture that. So I know that there are questions that you pose that you want to hear answers to as best we can give them, but, you know, I wish William well. I wish he was here with us. But, Mark, I think now we'll probably go ahead and turn it over to you, and we'll continue with the project.
Actually, Keith, go ahead.
So really got some really some good questions and thought-provoking. So thanks to everyone who participated and submitted questions. So we were going to have Mark read the questions and then I answer them. I was going, well, that's not very transparent because I, like, have the questions. So why don't I just read your questions and answer? I don't know why we would do that. So sorry, Mark. So it's
did fine. You just want to talk?
No.
Thanks for asking, right, Mark?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like my EQ's pretty low right now. And I was like, okay. So the first question was HCHB transition into one system and PCMS transition into continue link. And the question was, why do we need to do this, and how long will it take? So good questions. So Don, since that's a tough one, I'm gonna let you.
Oh gosh, for over a decade, Keith, I've been appreciative of that.
I get to choose which ones I take. I'm gonna take the layup, of course.
So we always talk about probably one of the hardest questions to answer is why. Why we do it. And if you think of it, whether it's a pyramid, Maslow's hierarchy of needs at the bottom, or a hub and spoke, I'd lend to the theory that home care home base is the vehicle that the operations inside of traditional home health reside within. So whether it's patient accounting and rev cycle that has to flow through that all the way through the spectrum and pillar program of ethics, most of our workflows, our associated policies, all have a relationship with a one type of instance in home care home base. And even going into this, I really didn't understand what the differences were in each of the instances. And so along with the CEO of Home Care Home Base, April Anthony, and our team, she explained it in this most simplistic fashion that resonated with me, is if you think of a house and the walls that comprise it, that's the platform of Home Care Home Base. But the way that you configure the rooms inside and then the direction that you have to walk within to get in and out are how the workflows are associated and the programmatic piece is built up. From admit and the way that we do intake all the way through QC workflows through SHP and a host of other things, the best way to predict and model certain pillar reports and results are to be in that one instance. So even at a cost and at a disruptive factor, in accordance with the divisional leaders that were almost family, everyone in unanimous fashion said, look, we've got to get there. If we are going to be in a room and talk about equality and quality, organic growth, we think we need this platform to be one and the same. So that is the real reason we did that. Obviously, and if Lynn were here, there is no doubt she would, Keith, shake her head yes, because our Florida division has been the first to embark upon conversion, and it's been lessons learned. For example, we felt that there would be minimal disruption to the clinical staff because they were already on home care home base, and the way that the OASIS embeddedness is viewed, we thought would be very similar. And that's all factual. But there were back office links that, even though they weren't vastly affected, position naming, the workflows were. And so it was a bigger disruptive factor that we've learned, and we are going to do a postmortem review so that the next group coming forth has the benefit of those lessons learned. All told, though, from a measure of success standpoint, with much effort, no turnover, or little, certainly none attributed to this in and of itself, no decay in admit growth, no decay in margin or profitability. So while, albeit tough, the why is what I tried to explain, and the how is going on now with an end date of somewhere around Q3 of next year. My last comment as to why I take that long, think about it. It is kind of like a tidal wave, if you would, or the wave inside of a stadium. When it starts, it gains momentum that can't be stopped, and you have to predictably model the effect to the operation. Because as my fellow operators know, we still must succeed in all pillar metrics of doing better quarter over quarter and year over year. So we've strategically put each of the divisions and states in queue to go at a certain time so that, in theory, the improvement in what we're going to see from Lynn and the team will essentially pay for and mask the decay and disruption of the next. So that while a sawtooth pattern will happen sequentially, in the aggregate, it's going to be an improvement year over year. Steve?
Yeah, and I guess the maybe at a stepping up above operations, you know, a company of this size, as we prepare to move more into value-based models and risk-based models where we're going to depend more heavily on analytics than we do today, being on one system and being able to organize and analyze data quickly is going to be imperative. And that is going to be a reality of ours. You know, we're an organization that moves. I guess we don't make knee jerk reactions. So when we see value based purchasing coming, so we're going to be piloting it in different locations. This move to one system is just a foundational place we have to get to be prepared to go there. But you're not going to wake up one morning and find out that we went all in on value-based purchasing. You know, we're not going to risk this whole battleship on that. But you know, again, think of my 10-year perspective that I referenced earlier. 10 years from now, I'd be willing to bet that I'm going to just say a significant portion of our revenue is in value-based models. It won't be insignificant. Today, it's insignificant. It's just a pilot here or there. But clearly, you know, clearly we're moving in that direction. So here's our challenge as an organization. And I think we're doing this well at this point. We need to continue to do this well. We need to be an organization that's capable of managing in both environments at the same time, not just at the home office level. In fact, most importantly, not at the home office level, but at the local level. So in every branch that we have, it's likely that we're going to have a subset of patients that are in a risk-based value model, and other patients that are in a fee-for-service model. We're not going to be so lucky that the switch is going to flip and they're going to say, oh, everything is in this value model now, or everything's in fee-for-service, which makes it even more challenging, which makes it even more important to be on one system, because those are challenges, and we'll overcome them together. But so this was a really good question. And I know for those that have to go through the conversion, I remember the experience of when we converted to home care, home base. There weren't a line of people standing outside the office high-fiving me for that decision, but to get where, you know, where we were going, it was a place we had to go. And but we say this on earnings calls publicly, it's in transcript quite often, that home care, home base happened to be the best thing out there and what we chose to go to. But what we really went to was point of care and a sole source solution so that we could analyze data and all. And one day something better than home care, home base may come along. I don't see it, but it may. But going for this organization, we went from paper and different systems and all kinds of assets we had acquired or merged and partnered with over the years to one single system, and that was just a huge game changer.
And Keith, if I may, it's the same theory with ContinuLink and PCMS, but interestingly, one of our assumptions going into the merger was not to convert to two at the beginning, because PCMS, of course, has been so instrumental in the historical success of Almost Family. Well, lo and behold, we find out with electronic visit verification, first in Ohio, imminently possibly in Florida and other, that we needed a bolt-on product. In this case, it was CareTrax. And so with new information and new dynamics, we actually took a step back. And again, with the input from all of the operators, as well as, I see Kathy and the team there, we had a group come together and say, okay, is this still the direction? Or after getting consensus from every key stakeholder, do we now want to convert to that one system? And of course, you know, because the question is the latter. And so that's what we're doing as well there, and we'll convert. And my last comment is, at this time, ContinuLink will still allow us to get some point of care into the homes when we move into different skill parameters of the service. So again, that's the why there, and it's very much, Keith, in accordance with what you said. And then lastly, both will allow interoperability with our joint venture partners as we continue to build out these services nationwide.
Okay, so the next question comes from, I don't know, I don't know who. Mark didn't give me the who's, but it comes from a very crafty question master who I'm assuming does part-time work on one of the cable news channels, because I think there are six or seven questions in the one question. What are we doing to position ourselves for PDGM if the rule stands how it is written today? Do you think anything will change with the rule between now and January 2020? Does our acquisition strategy change at all with the impending rule? So, Don, what are we doing? You take the part of what are we doing to prepare now, between now and January 2020, as it's written today.
So I think I'll lead with what we're not doing or what we do not intend to do.
That wasn't the question.
I know. But much like some of the people that answer those, it's an important point that I really, in seriousness, Keith, want to make to the team. We've been doing this a very long time, and much like we said about the challenges of the merger, we're going to have changes in reimbursement methodology and regulatory landscape, period. We will never, as a company, manipulate or alter in any way visit patterns, interventional needs for patients, period. And that's something that is vital to get out there, because Keith talked about the behavioral piece of the rule. CMS is assuming that we'll have behavioral changes, and of course we will. But my first point is we cannot and will not ever eliminate needs of patients and therefore alter visit patterns based on diagnosis groups. However, there are things that we're doing, because the way the rule is written, if you really get underneath it, from the way patients are received from acute care versus community, there are a ton of substantive changes. We are developing an internal task force as well as outside resources that come in to first look at, if we did nothing, how would those visit patterns look and what would be the anticipated effect on outcomes. That will then gear us, much like the nursing process, right? You have to assess before you plan and intervene. That will then allow us to look by diagnostic group how the 30-day period will be, and then subsequently what we'll need to provide in the revisited periods. So the what we're doing is really getting underneath how our existing patient population will be affected, and then we're going to relook at visits, utilizations, and what I'll call other service lines to make sure that the patients get the same continuity of care as today. We're not there. We're not even close. I think Richard's in our room. It took us, you know, probably a month and a half to really get under the detail and get a thorough assessment. So you'll hear more to come as the months go by, but that's where we stand today.
So I'll take the next part, which is, you know, do you expect changes in the rule? You know, what you just heard from Don is what we should be doing and what we've always done here. And it could fall under that, be described as hope for the best and plan for the worst. So we're thinking and preparing for the rule exactly as it's written today. In our financial modeling, I told you we just met with the board and did our five-year plan. So in our financial modeling, we're preparing for what's proposed. But then we're working for something better. That being said, my experience has some value in handicapping. I wouldn't bet any money if there's any kind of Vegas odds going on this. Don't bet on what I'm about to tell you. But I do believe that we're going to see modifications. You know, you can start to pick up on the tone from people. And the other thing, this is not insignificant. There's bipartisan legislation pending in both the House and the Senate. And on the Senate side, the lead sponsor of that legislation is Senator Susan Collins. And, you know, after the Kavanaugh hearings, she's got some clout, you know, and she is a huge home care champion. And not only has she got her feet, and I just met with her last week, not only does she has planted a flag on this as her issue, and she's been a home care champion for a long time. This is not something new or that she's doing for some constituent. I mean, she's passionate about home care, period. But we ask for is a fix in this. She's reaching beyond that and wants a loosening of homebound criteria. So for patients with multiple chronic conditions, she thinks the homebound criteria bright line is outdated. We think that too. What's interesting is Mark Miller, the former director of MedPAC. I seem to be talking in decades today. I feel really old. But this is probably close to 10 years ago. A group of us from the industry were in a meeting at MedPAC, who we think of as an adversary. And Mark Miller said, he made a statement. He said, "You might be surprised by what I'm about to say," he said, "but I think the homebound criteria is outdated. And I think patients with multiple chronic conditions that have a pattern of hospitalizations should be, the homebound criteria should be waived because there's a lot of money that would be saved caring for those patients at home." The problem that he said that he was faced with back then was underwriting the risk. Essentially, who's going to guarantee that the savings are going to show up if we loosen this criteria and deploy more home health? We didn't have the answer back then, but just a while ago we were talking about value-based models and bundles. you know, it's there are companies like Landmark that have popped up managing those high-risk, high-cost patient populations and doing that very thing today. And that could be a place you see us in the future, taking specific patients and taking financial responsibility for them. Remember I said a subset of patients in a local branch, some that are at risk and some to fee for service? It's not unreasonable to believe that we could have in each branch 10, 15, 20 really high-cost Medicare beneficiaries that we take full risk for and manage their care. So I guess going back to the changes in the rule, I think all of those things are going to cause people to think twice before they do something that could disrupt the momentum in home care, and that's huge support. So we'll see how that turns out, and I'm sure I'll be, if it doesn't turn out well, later next year I'll be embarrassed on a future town hall call. The other thing, of course, that we're working is the rural add-on and the expiration of that in time or, you know, in years to come. Richard, it's time for you to come off mute and talk about a rural add-on. What do you think?
What do I think?
Yeah.
Well, we've already started lobbying to reinstate the 3% rural add-on, and as usual, we do have a lot of support in Congress.
Good job.
Sorry about that. As usual, we do have a lot of support in Congress, and ironically, many of the biggest supporters are Democrats in the House. So I don't think we suffered anything as a result of the midterms. It's way too early to predict if we'll be successful, because we will have to identify a pay for. That means an equivalent amount of money to offset the increased spending. But I'm optimistic that we will be able to get it reinstated by the end of next year, and we'll keep you posted on our activities.
That's a good question. I want to hit after this chat. So the Mark is trying to move me along, and I don't know. No, so because this was a good question. So the third question in the one question of the savvy question asker was, does this affect our acquisition strategy? I would say yes, and thank God. So, you know, really, so if I look back at the history of our history in the industry, our largest volume acquisition, M&A, joint venture activity has been in the years immediately following a significant rule change. Disruption in the industry is good if you have your act together, because when everyone else is scrambling and paralyzed and figuring out, you know, what are we going to do, how are we going to deal with this, and you're not scared of the future and you don't have an exit strategy and you're in it long term, you take advantage of those opportunities. Case in point, we're a public company. This is in the public file, as you can go look this up. In 2008, major rule change took place. We were much smaller than on the LHC side. We added 68 new locations in that 1 year. How we integrated all of that, I don't know. Angie's thinking, I know. I think it's a huge opportunity for us, and especially in the hospital joint venture space. You know, the activity we have now is unprecedented, but I think this will only enhance it. Okay, so now I'm going to move to question three, and Mark's giving me the whatever. So the next question is, what's the status of the new building in Lafayette? So we're on schedule. In fact, Mark, I'll come off mute. You're going to ask that question.
Yeah, great. Hello, everyone. Just wanted to give an update. Carl Como is probably the best one to give the update, but I'll do my best. Right now, for the Lafayette employees, Lafayette-based home office employees, we're actually operating in three offices. We are here at Hugh Wallace. We have an office building on Pinhook, which is about 5 minutes away, and we have another where IT is housed. So we're operating in three locations. The goal is to consolidate and expand this campus building, and we're going to be adding 143,000 square feet. Within the next 2 weeks, we're going to be doing some work on building out a parking lot, which is adjacent to the space that we're on today. That's going to be completed in a four-month time period. We have some demo that needs to be done first. And then we will begin on the expansion project. We expect to be fully moved in and operational in August of 2020.
Okay, thanks, Mark. Next question is, what do you see as the single biggest challenge for our organization in 2019? We talked about this at the board meeting. We're going to answer this one really, really quickly. People. Really, it's people. So whereas we have so much opportunity for growth, but we have to recruit and retain people that align with our culture and our mission and our values and have the skills necessary to provide exceptional patients to those we serve. That's our challenge. I mean, if you have to pick one, that's it. And so there are a lot of things that we're doing to position ourselves better, to be competitive, but we never get good enough. So a lot of you provide feedback. I get most of the emails I get are about opportunities and ideas that people have how to enhance that. Please don't stop that. And I know that that we're working really hard at it. You want to add anything to that?
You know, Keith, of course you're spot on. And you know, as an example, just this morning, myself, Cheryl, and Nate up in the Northeast were really brainstorming on how do we really continue to be the employer of choice for the heart. And it takes a lot of work. And so, of course, it's our biggest challenge. I think what I would encourage us all to do is incorporate something every day that we do differently to better meet that challenge. Because it's not an easy thing, and it's not just about money and cell phone allowance and the things that trigger some of these. It really is an intense effort to listen very well to the team and meet their needs. And when we have to say no or there are tough questions or expectations we can't meet, go back to the first question in this town hall and explain the why. Because it is a starch fact and statistically known that high performers really want to know that answer. And once they do get it, they can accept it and move on. So it is absolutely imperative that we stop what we call the back door. We decrease turnover. We stop turnover, and at the same time, make a concerted effort in accordance with our recruiters to attract the best talent in our markets. It's just something that I would encourage us all, from Keith and myself all the way down to every single person who really matter most, and make this the best place in healthcare that they can work.
Yeah, well said. So the next question is, what is your advice on keeping our family culture intact as we continue to grow as a company? This question comes up almost every time we ask for questions, and I don't know if people expect a different answer or not, but you know, this is what I believe the answer is, and then I get confirmation of that from outside people that tell me, keep telling me that that's what the answer is, and not an employees of ours, not people who would tell me what I want to hear, outside people. In fact, just yesterday we had a group in this very room of really high-level hospital industry executives who are consultants that we were asking what resonates with all of the hospitals and health systems, a lot of them big hospitals and health systems, when we go in to talk to them about potential joint venture relationships. And I think I'll speak for myself. I asked the question expecting to hear value-based purchasing and complex formulas and secret sauce things we had and all that. And these really high-level people told me that we needed to lead with telling the story about our company. Blew me away, like how the company was founded, the fact that we don't have an exit strategy, all of those things that, you know, I tend to think, oh, that's kind of hokey or Mayberry or whatever. And, you know, these people who don't know me and don't have any reason to tell me that, go, no, all those other things are important, but you got to lead with that. When we have EBD for all the new leaders, the Excellence by Design, for all the new leaders in the company that come in. And Ginger and I have made a commitment on the first day that we sit, the very first thing they see is we sit with them and tell them what we're all about, how did the company start, what was the vision, why did it start, and all of those things. So I think there are a lot of things we can do to support the work, but somebody at the local level that hires an employee has to tell that story. I mean, we're and I tell everyone in EBD that. I'm going, I mean, my one ask is that you go back and spread this message. Why, you know, why are we here in the first place? And, you know, let's just remember the quick, let's not be ashamed to admit that this company started, this wasn't even a company, right? So this mission started without a business plan. I mean, without a business plan, no intention to be a business, just four people that showed up asking for help. And Ginger was a nurse and went and took care of four people before and after going to work at a hospital. So we didn't have an exit strategy, a business plan, or any of that. If we had had that, if it had been a financial calculation, we'd have never joint ventured with the first hospital in 1998 when we were still cost reimbursed. That would not have made any sense if you had started something to sell. And so throughout the whole history of the company, we've been on a mission. And I think that's a big part of our culture. So I just encourage all of you to help push that down to the lowest possible level. Cameron, do you have a microphone over there on that end? Do they?
Okay.
Right now.
Yes, sir.
So, Cameron, you spent a lot of years going around the country doing this very thing. So can I ask you to share a little bit of your perspective on this?
One thing you mentioned when you were talking about that is something you said, it's something we shouldn't be ashamed of. To me, it's something we should be incredibly proud of, is that, because this is the first time I've ever heard, even though I've known about it, the term no exit strategy. I love that. But I think the fact that the reason we got into this was for four people. I think Mr. and Ms. King, Ms. Simeon, and Mr. Johnson, maybe. Those four people, that's why we, all of us sitting around these conference tables right now, started, whether we were here or not, for those four people. And I think that's the most powerful message we have. I mean, there's all kinds of other things that filters down to and that colors that picture, but we didn't start to become what we are today. We started, as you said several times, as a mission but the mission was for four people. And that's the best story we have, because that's our story.
Yeah. Very, very good. Now, Mark, how are we doing on time?
We're good. We've got about 7 minutes, so I think we've got time for one or two more questions.
Okay. What's that?
Number eight.
Number eight?
Yep.
Okay.
That's a good idea.
All right. Yes, perfect. What plans exist for the Louisville home office? Will it remain open and operational in the future? I'm sorry I giggled a bit of that, but we are 100% committed. If it's possible to be more committed, we're more committed than 100% to maintaining the Louisville office. As I shared in our last town hall call, there are several things going on in Louisville. I mean, first of all, it's Kentucky has, since 2006, been the second largest volume state in LHC prior to this merger. Kentucky's always been the second largest volume state. For years now, our board has been pressing us to have a second home office location, not to be solely dependent on just one home office location, but to have redundancy, because we happen to be in Louisiana, and they have these little things called hurricanes that come through here every now and then. So finally, from a board perspective, we've checked that block, and we have redundancies. As we move past integration and continue to plan for the future, Louisville is going to be very strategic in that disaster planning initiative for the company. And then, you know, of course, it's home for all of you that I'm looking at now that support services that and do vital work to support the service lines that we brought over that weren't core in LAC prior to this merger. The question comes up, to me it's obvious that there's, at least in somebody's mind, there's some question about the commitment to that location. There should be no question. And, you know, this might be an even bigger level of commitment. So both Senator McConnell and Senator Paul have talked to me about the office in Louisville and expressed their appreciation for us having a presence in Louisville. And I explained to them what I just explained to you. So, I mean, we're so public with this commitment. There's no discussion that ever takes place about anything with Louisville other than thank God we have Louisville. So we're just one home office, right? Remember 3 months ago we said this. We're one home office with two physical locations, but just one team.
We're going to be putting out a key sign on the building.
Oh, and Marcus just reminded me that LHC sign is going up in Louisville when?
In the next few weeks. We're working out logistics.
Next few weeks. So out of, you know, respect for all of you, we didn't advance the thought of putting the LHC sign up. I thought it was respectful to leave the Almost Family sign up. And then William and I were talking one morning, and he said, I think the LHC sign shouldn't go up because people feel like there's not as much commitment because the LHC sign up. And I went, oh, my God. Well, let's put the LHC sign up. That's being perceived wrong. So
I think we're good. I would encourage if there's other questions, if anyone else has questions that perhaps either weren't answered or to continue to send those in to ask.lhc at lhcgroup.com, or certainly to send them to Don or to Keith directly, as you always have.
So. And Keith, before you close, I just want to say thank you to all for all the heavy lifting, and in short, have a very blessed and safe holiday season. Keith?
Yeah, absolutely. Just thank you. Thank you for all of your hard work, and to everyone in Louisville, thank you for your hospitality and for welcoming us into your family. And it's just we just have a lot to be thankful for as we enter this holiday season. We're very blessed. We really are. So thank you, and Merry Christmas, and to everyone.
Have a good evening.